Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nimmers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Nailers Natter. I'm Abby Bayford, and today I've got the pleasure of interviewing Paul Ainsworth, School Improvement Director at Infinity Academies Trust and Director of Education at the Blessed Peter Snow. And I'm going to talk to Paul about his ninth book, What an Achievement, No Silver Bullets, Day In, Day Out School Improvement. So welcome, Paul.
Hi, Abby. Thanks very much for inviting me on the podcast. It's a kind of real pleasure to talk to you.
No, it's great to have you on. So before we kickstart and talk about the new book, if there's any of our listeners who don't know about your career to date, could you tell them a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I've kind of been really privileged to have a fantastic range of jobs. So I started off a very traditional maths teacher, PE teacher, head of maths, deputy head, head of school, you know, very traditional. And then about 6 years ago, I joined one of the big multi-academy trusts. I joined the David Ross Education Trust as a system leader. And over the last 6 years, I've just had such a fantastic range of opportunities. I mean, you know yourself, I mean, the privilege you've got of running the ATT Institute, you know, kind of looking after professional development in a large multi-academy trust, which I did previously, is just wonderful. And to work with head teachers and trying to support head teachers, you know, with the challenges they have, is just an immense privilege. So I've done that over the last 6 years. I've worked in kind of four multi-academy trusts. So I'm now on my third and fourth at the moment, and work across a whole range of schools. And I just love it. I just love the variety. I love working with head teachers. I love going into schools. That is what I do. That's a little bit about my career over the kind of last 6 years. And I'll probably go into a little bit more detail later on about some of those experiences.
I feel like I need a whole podcast about how you got from maths teacher to PE teacher, but we might need to unpick that at another time. But what does shine through for me, having read parts of the book and still waiting in the post for my copy, is the mature understanding you have of the school improvement journey. That's really evident in what you write. So we've already established you've written quite a plethora of books. I don't quite know how you found the time. It's impressive. But why have you decided to write another book, and what did you hope to achieve?
So a large part of my work at the moment is going into schools and supporting head teachers with the different issues that they've got. And it's a whole range of issues. You can go into a school and it's around attainment. It could be around progress. It could be attendance is low. It could be we're struggling with behaviour. And over the last 6 years, I've kind of collected together a set of strategies that just little tweaks, little hints that I give head teachers. So if I go into a school and I walk around and, people ask for advice and say, you know, what can we do? And I've got little ideas that I suggest to head teachers. A couple of years ago, one of the head teachers said, can you not just write all this stuff down? Can I just have it so that I don't always need you to come into school? I love you coming into school, but I don't get you coming in every week. It might be every month or every half term. Could you just write all your ideas down so that I can just work my way through them? And it was a kind of jokey conversation, but that was the germination. That was the idea of, okay, yeah, why don't I put those ideas down? We talk sometimes about a playbook, don't we? So there's the kind of famous All Blacks book that was written quite recently about the rugby team, you know, and they talk about they developed a playbook of what they did. So the idea of no silver bullets is it's my playbook, it's my school improvement playbook. And I'm not saying all the answers are in there, far from it. It's hopefully a book that will evolve over time. But for those head teachers that I've had, you know, real privilege of working with, what I wanted was, there you are, there's the ideas. If you've forgotten some of them, or if you want to have a flick through, or if you've got this one issue that you want to work on, have a look through and see if there's something in there that might help you. And the same as if you're on that journey, if you're a school leader and you're trying to get to be a head teacher, you know, deputy head or an assistant head or director of studies, those type of roles, you can then look through whatever your specialism is and see if there's some ideas that can help you. And the other thing is, you know, we're both system leaders and it's very different from being a school leader. So I wanted to try and provide some advice for system leaders because there isn't a lot out there. There aren't many kind of books of that ilk. So part of it is there's so many people at the moment, whether they're specialist leaders of education, whether they're evidence leaders of education, whether they're LLEs, whether they're people like us working for multi-academy trusts, but they're going in to support schools. And I wanted to kind of give them some ideas, not to say these are all the answers, but just have a look through. If you've got an issue, could some of these things help you? They are tweaks. They're marginal gains. They're not, you know, they are not silver bullets, but hopefully they can just help that range of colleagues to improve schools. Because it's about the whole system. It's about all children. I don't want to work in an environment where we just support our own schools. We just help our own schools get better. Multi-academy trusts have brought it home to me that it's not just our own MAT. It's how do we support MATs outside? It's how we work with schools and the local authority. And one of the wonderful things about writing the book in the kind of last few weeks has been the amount of contact I've had with leaders in other multi-academy trusts, you know, yeah. Having conversations with me. You know, this is what we're doing in our MAT. What do you think, Paul? Have you got any suggestions? Or I'm buying the book and I'm buying it for all my head teachers. You know, I've had a couple of CEOs say that, and that's the idea. I don't think we should work in isolation. I think one of the great things about teachers all the time is we share ideas, we magpie. So that's part of the idea of writing the book is, hey, there's great stuff out there. I want all schools to be great. I want all children to have a great experience. And hopefully there might be something in the book that could help a head teacher, deputy head teacher, system leader, even a CEO to help their schools get better in their area.
You make such an important distinction between leading in one academy and leading across academies as a system leader. And it is important we make that distinction because it's different. I always remember Sir David Carter saying that you can only say a strategy is effective when you put it through the filter of a new location. And you make adaptations to your strategy then through that process as well. And it's very evident that whilst you offer some very tangible strategies, you also codify what that collaboration looks like and the collaboration that's necessary for those strategies to work. And so what I'm keen to know, and I'm sure our listeners will want to know as well, is what experiences do you think have enabled you to write about this book? So I know you've talked about your history to date, but could you isolate it to some particular sources of inspiration?
Okay. And I think the first big inspiration was joining DRET, you're joining the David Ross Education Trust. And I went from a very comfortable existence of being a head of a school I'd been in for a period of time. And on my first day, I went to work in a school two hours from where I live in a town that I didn't know, didn't really understand the context. I went from a very small rural secondary school to supporting a large urban school in the middle of Northampton, and with, you know, kind of high EAL, high pupil premium, and results had really dipped. Fantastic new head teacher had been appointed, and this was Malcolm Arnold Academy in Northampton, and they were on the start of their journey. They were on the start of the journey out of inadequate, and it was this big urban school, and it was, where do we start from? What is the fresh start that this school's required? And I worked intensively with that school and with the head teacher and the leadership team over a couple of terms, and then would keep dropping back in to support them on their journey. And I watched that school go from inadequate to good over a 3-year period. And it was always a really exciting, vibrant school to go in. I loved going into that school. But that taught me a lot around being a system leader. And you don't have a hierarchical role. Always have to bring people with you. You're only as good as the last piece of work you've done. And people, you know, maybe a little bit suspicious to start off with, what's the motivation? And I had to work really hard to build trust with those colleagues. And I did reach the point of, eventually whenever I went in that school, I got such a warm welcome from a whole range of staff. So that was a really important moment for me, working in a very different type of school and being a system leader. I worked in a number of secondary schools over those two terms, and each at a time it was looking at the strategies that were being used in those schools. They were very different secondary schools, from a large urban secondary school to a rural, what could have been classed as a secondary modern because there were grammar schools in the area, you know, with very small numbers of pupils. Mm-hmm. So trying to work out what they needed as well. And then the second really big learning moment was towards the end of that year, I became chair of interim executive boards for primary schools and secondary schools. And it was at the point where Key Stage 2 levels were changed from the old 3As, 2As, 2Bs to ARE. And I started to work in primary schools, and that was a new opening for me. It was something I hadn't really done before. But it was an interesting time because levels were changing, so nobody knew. It was a real point of turbulence in the primary sector. And I can always remember attending my first primary head teachers meeting with DRET, and there were probably 21, 22 primary head teachers in the room, a range of system leaders, and the director of education and regional directors. And I sat there and just listened to these amazing conversations. And I was scribbling down so many ideas. And I've still got the A4 sheet of paper sat on my desk at home. And it is one side of really packed notes. And I sat there at the end of the day and I put a note on the top of almost copying the John Tomsett idea, this much I could learn from primary schools. Mm-hmm. And I had that moment of, if I took some of these ideas from the primary sector and moved them into secondary, it would make a massive difference. And vice versa, if I could take some of my secondary ideas in terms of the forensic use of data and that and how you manage data sets and put that over in primary, that could really make a difference. And the two sectors could really learn from each other. Now, at that point, I also became head of the teaching school for DRET, so I was responsible for CPD. I had the wonderful opportunity of having a new head teachers group, an aspirant head teachers group, and also a system leaders group, which I facilitated. So I got this opportunity of bringing these groups of people together so they could share experiences. The learning that I was getting as I moved from a primary school to a secondary school and back again, and to share this as well. And those were two, really key moments. When I left DRET and went to another multi-academy trust, I had the opportunity then of, I can test my ideas in a different setting that you mentioned about David Carter, to take that school improvement model and move it into a group of 14 primary schools where I didn't know the people, I didn't have the history that I had with that previous multi-academy trust, but to import that school improvement model of working with head teachers, trying to find the little things that would make a difference. And it really worked. Data really went up over the course of that year. And at that point, I thought, I want to write the book now. I've tested it in another opportunity. And that was when I started writing the book in September 2019. And at that time, Infinity Academy's trust was growing. And that was my next key moment, because I joined a very different trust. This is a very family trust. We all know each other. This is the kind of trust where we are all in it for each other. The head teachers of this trust are so supportive of each other, and I don't get pushback. It's very much, okay, let's have the conversation. What would work? What would improve our schools? So to then put the model in that environment, does it still work? Yes, it still works. It still works across these schools, and we've got some real traction. And the CEO, Gavin Booth, is so open to ideas of how can we make this group of primary schools better. So those, I suppose, are my four key experiences that I learnt the ideas. I then looked at them in the primary setting. I worked across a big map, 34 schools, to try and put some of those ideas in practice. I then went to another map where I didn't know people, tried it again. Yes, it worked. It had an impact on data. And now I'm in my third and fourth mat, trialing it again. Yes, it's still working. There must be something in there. There must be something in those ideas.
It's really interesting to hear you talk about what secondary leaders can learn from primary and vice versa. And from my experience, I don't think we do enough of it. I think sometimes we can be guilty as leaders of thinking, you don't understand my context. We have different challenges. And so it's really nice to hear an example of how that's worked really well. And it's clear from hearing you talk about your experiences that whilst the book is about school improvement journeys, you've clearly been on a leadership journey yourself that has enabled you to write this book. And something that struck me, and we hadn't talked about this in advance, just is the level of emotional intelligence involved in school improvement. And you clearly have a really good understanding of social awareness, so how to develop a rapport with new people, and relationship management as well. So understanding others' emotions and treating them the way they need to be treated based on where they might be on that school improvement journey. How important do you think emotional intelligence is to this style of leadership?
It is so critical. And I think probably one of the moments where that really hit was I was working in a school in Hull, Ainthorpe Primary Academy. I'd been the chair there at IEB for a year, and results had really dipped. They were the lowest results in Hull. And we knew we had to improve performance. We knew we had to improve performance for the children because they deserved better than that. And I can remember going into school in that September when we were having the restart. There was a new head teacher. We'd got some new colleagues. And the confidence of the teaching staff was so low. They were really good people, but their confidence was low. And it was that perfect storm of trying to set aspirations too high, actually. A new data system coming in, a lot of turbulence, you know, in the school, and the results had dipped. And I realised that at that moment, what I had to do was a chair of the board and also as a system leader working with a new head teacher was to help that fantastic head teacher, but build her confidence and help her build the confidence of her staff. She was under real pressure to, you know, move those results up. It was, you know, 24% ARE, and it was her first role as head teacher. She'd been acting head before, and a wonderfully, wonderfully emotionally intelligent lady, Kate Ranner, and a great deputy head in Shane Davey, and other staff were fab, but we had to build a team. And what I had to do with them was saying, you're on the right track. You can do this. It's difficult now, but you've just got to keep going one day at a time, keep chipping away, and you will get there. Because they were, is it going to work, Paul? Are the results going to be the same as last year? What happens if they're the same as last year? And what I had to keep doing was say, no, you're on the right track. Give challenge where it was needed, but really think about what was the right level of challenge to give. Because if I pushed too hard, that confidence could have just completely disappeared. Mm-hmm. And that was a really interesting, difficult year. And probably it is the highlight of my school improvement work, because what happened over the course of that year with Kate and with Shane and that staff was that they took their key stage two data, they took the results, we're thinking this is looking good. And we got an inspection on the day the results came out. So we sat there in an Ofsted inspection with 24% ARE. 24%, which is inadequate. There's no getting away from that. It is inadequate. But we also knew these key stage two results were going to be great. Mm-hmm. We knew they were going to be really good. And we went through this, and the results came out while Ofsted were there. But they said, well, they're unvalidated. And I was going, yeah, but look. And the results went up from 24 to the high 60s. Wow. And we convinced the inspection team that this was a good school. Mm-hmm. And that kind of when we got that judgment, I was chair, I was in a lot of the meetings with Kate, and kind of in feedback meetings and those kind of things, and trying to bring my educational knowledge to support the leadership team, trying to work out when to push an inspector and when not, when to challenge them. And when they came out and told us the school was good, that was just an amazing achievement for that community as well. Mm. It's not in the best area. It supports a challenging area of high deprivation, but that school has every right to be good, as just as much as any school. And I've watched the journey continue. So Kate went on to another headship and Shane became head teacher, and I'm still in contact with Shane. And listening to the journey of that school is fantastic.
That's really inspiring.
So, yeah, that emotional intelligence of kind of knowing when to push, when to put your arm around somebody, when to give them confidence, when to challenge. Mm. Yeah, that's absolutely crucial.
And you also made me think about this idea of how do we galvanise stakeholders around the idea that a school's getting better when you don't yet have the performance data? So we know that performance isn't static, but we also know it takes a time for all of those school improvement efforts to translate into improved pupil outcomes. So that's really difficult to do, isn't it?
And there's a lot in there, and there's a lot you can actually do. And that brings us to remote learning at the moment in some ways. Some of the schools I'm working in at the moment have got low data sets, and we've not got any new data, but I know the school's got better. Mm. I mean, I can always remember a story from, I can't remember the name of the system leader now. The system leader who was working in a school in London that was really, really deprived, really struggling, was kind of known as the worst school in London. And when he first came into the school, what he did was he really focused on, when he was doing his staff briefings, telling the staff three good things about that week, and making sure those, a bit like the Dr. Pookie's idea of, you know, three good things every day for your mental health well-being. So he did the three good things in this school every week, and he tried to get it out into the press and out in newsletters. And he wrote in the book, after about 5 or 6 weeks, the staff were coming up to him and saying, this school's getting better. It's really good. And he writes in his book of, there was no real difference. We hadn't had chance to change anything. It was still a tough school in poor buildings. Performance hadn't really improved. Quality of teaching hadn't improved, but we'd started to change the culture. And actually, yes, you know, whether your school's changed or not, whether it's improved or not, the way you talk about it can give people that confidence, give the community the confidence, give the pupils the confidence. And if they start to believe it's getting better, that gives even more energy to the improvement, and that kind of self-replication, those wheels that turn. So there is a really big piece of work there in building confidence and trying to pass on the good points in your school, you know, however difficult it is. And I think if you're in a challenging school at the moment with low data, and you can't show that improvement in Key Stage 2 SATs from last year, or GCSE Progress 8, or those kind of things, it's so important to share the good news. Look, this is what we've done. This is where we've made a difference for that child. Hey, on remote learning, we've got 11 children on Zoom today in that class, whereas yesterday we had 9. And next week we've got 12. And we're getting there. It might be small numbers to start off with, but keep telling people the positive, keep telling people the improvement, and people then, they feel it. Oh, my school's improving.
And I'm going to ask you later on in the interview about the transferability of the ideas in the book, given the new and wonderful way we're working. But before I do, I want to take you back to the beginning and ask you to talk to our listeners about the title. So why Silver Bullets?
Okay, so I was probably guilty of this when I was a school leader, of looking for the magic idea that will transform my school. Mm. And I can remember on my MPQH final residential, a gentleman talking to us about vertical tutor groups and how vertical tutor groups had transformed his school. And I can remember scribbling down, I need to take vertical tutor groups back to my school. I can vividly remember the the applied ICT qualifications were 4 or 6 GCSEs, the IDA, CIDA, DIDA route that some listeners will remember from secondary. I'm thinking, oh, is that going to transform? If I bring that in, if I do those qualifications, will it transform my school? Will that be the silver bullet? Moving on from my career, is it a math scheme? I'm in a primary school. Is that math scheme going to make the difference? Is that going to transform? Or a certain phonics scheme, will that make the difference? And I can always remember one of the head teachers talking to me, and I don't know how true this is, about a research project that was done in the late 90s, so a long, long time ago. And the research project was on outstanding schools, and a management consultant went around a whole range of outstanding schools to try and work out what they had in common. And the big overarching conclusion was outstanding schools had plants in their foyer. And that there is an urban myth that at that time, schools suddenly went out and put plants in their foyers, that welcoming, that was the calming thing that was going to make a difference for children and visitors. That kind of silver bullet, that's ridiculous. I can see you laughing, Abby.
And imagining, the reason why I'm laughing, because I'm imagining rainforest receptions across the UK and us fighting our way through plants just to get to the reception hatch.
And we've probably all seen that in some schools, haven't we? And it's that idea of silver bullets. Now, so if we, that's the ridiculous, the plants, isn't it? But if we take the example of, say, vertical tutor groups or incorporating a new math scheme, and there's no doubt that in some schools that has transformed those schools, but it's transformed the schools because they've taken that as an idea and used it to galvanise staff, and it's impacted all across the curriculum. It's impacted all across the school. It wasn't that silver bullet that transformed the school, it was the way of working.
Yeah.
Now, I've taken that a stage further, and what I'm saying is, yes, you can put in different systems. There's times when you're in a really challenging school where you might have to lift and shift. You might have to take one thing and put it in to give people, to give staff a good start. But I don't think that is the answer. I really believe, reading Clive Woodward, who was the coach of the England rugby team in 2005, that idea of you take 100 ideas and you make those 100 things 1% better. And once you've done those, you make them another 1% better. Or David Brailsford, who talked about the aggregation of marginal gains when he was involved in British cycling. Now, that's what No Silver Bullets is about. It's about here's 100 little things that you could do in your school, and those 1% will add up. And if you keep doing them day in, day out, you're not going to get the answer in 2 weeks. That's not going to happen. It takes time to transform a school. There's a reason why Ofsted teams have windows to come back. Inadequate schools, 2 years, then 3 years for an RI school, because it takes that time to improve your school. So the idea of no silver bullets is here are a whole list of little things. They are not the big transformations. They are the little things that if you look at, okay, so I need to improve my quality of teaching and learning. Let's read through, which of these am I doing? Tick, tick, tick. Oh, I hadn't thought of that. It's not going to rip anything else up, but it's going to be something that you can do to improve. Or you've gone into a school and outcomes are really low and you need something to move outcomes quickly. What can you do? So here's some things that you could do in terms of how you set up your data structures or how you run different things or how you do interventions. And if you do them, they will make a difference, and keep plugging away at them, they'll make a big difference.
I agree. I think it's really important actually to have that library of experiences, particularly if you are new to post. So we know that if you compare the mental models of novice and expert teachers, what expert teachers have in their bag is a library of experiences that they can draw on. They make decisions constantly, dismiss possibilities because they've already experienced failure perhaps with that, or they know this one won't work in this context. They have that really sophisticated understanding because of that library. If you are a new leader, you might not yet have that library of experiences. So I always think it's not enough to just say, study your locality, be intuitive, be responsive, if you don't necessarily have some practical things that you could try to make things better. And that's what I really like about your book.
I had a really good, really wonderful tweet on Tuesday. A lady you have not met before, acting head teacher in the West Midlands, had bought my book and said, I've read it through tonight. I've just sat there and read all of it. And she said, you've just made me believe everything that I always thought. That, you know, that kind of, I thought this was the way to improve schools. And by reading your book, I'm now even more confident. And she was saying that she was going on to have an interview for a headship in the next couple of weeks. And from reading my book, she just felt really confident to tackle that because she wanted some validation that the ideas that she was using in her school could work. And that when I saw that tweet or that direct message on Monday, I was like, yes, that's the reason I've written that book. You know, I think she's a head teacher of a, you know, standalone school, so maybe doesn't have lots of people coming in, coaching her and advising her and working on different areas. She's there on her own with her senior leadership team, and the whole school is looking for her for the answers. And that's a really lonely position to be in.
It is.
And you do constantly, am I doing the right thing? Will this make a difference? So that when I got that message and I messaged her back and, you know, said that that has made my day, that's been worth writing the book to get that tweet.
So who is the target audience of the book?
So I think, you know, I've touched on it. The target audience is that wide range of leaders. Mm. I think that if you are an aspiring senior leader, you can get ideas out of it. I think all the way through, you know, senior leadership, and then the system leaders. I think there's a real audience in system leaders working across schools. But I think it's people with whole school roles. It's not for primary or secondary. It's for both sectors. I've categorised the ideas that these are things that are very primary. So it might be around phonics. It might be around EYFS that by its nature fits to primary. And there's some areas where I've said, you know, I've suggested this is probably a secondary item, but still read it. You might get the idea. But when you look through the book, the vast range of them do duplicate over primary and secondary. And I've had some really interesting conversations with early years practitioners, you know, who've said, oh, I'm going to take some of these. I'm going to see how these will work in my setting. And that's really fascinating as well. I mean, that's a whole different world working in an early years setting, and something that I've found fascinating to be involved with over the last 4 years as well.
That's really great to hear. I mean, I'm not primary trained, I'm secondary, but work with so many primary leaders in our trust, and they often say they feel quite excluded from school improvement discussions, books, feel that it's often explored through a secondary lens. So that I think that will be really reassuring for our listeners who are working in a primary context.
And I think that the way that primary leaders transform schools is something that we can all learn from. Mm-hmm. It's certainly true in the experiences that I've had that primary leaders have been able to transform schools faster than secondary leaders. And I don't think it's just size. I think there is something in the way, in the culture of primary schools and the way that teachers work together and the way that leaders work. So I think that we can learn so much from both sectors. And the moment we close our eyes, we just miss fantastic opportunities. And certainly some of the ways that primary schools develop quality of teaching and learning is, you know, really fundamental to the book, and how they, you know, develop writing in children that secondary practitioners can really learn from. And certainly I can remember a secondary teacher who did take a whole tranche of primary ideas, and that really worked in his school. And it pushed quality of teaching and learning up very quickly. Such an open-minded person to do that. And that was about 4 or 5 years ago. And he'd had a system leader journey of secondary and then supporting primary schools. So then he'd magpied all those things and took them back. And he's now, Dave Lancaster, who's head in Lancashire, now, and kind of I know he's doing a fantastic job in the school that he's working in to kind of make that even better.
So talking of transmitting ideas, let's come back to the present. We're obviously working in a very different context right now. Are there any ideas from the book that are transferable to remote working and, well, remote education?
So again, I think, first of all, the premise of the book, of no silver bullets, there isn't a magic answer to remote learning. We've seen in the press, haven't we, and different commentators say the answer is live lessons. Mm-hmm. You've got to do 5 hours of live lessons every day. Well, as the parent of two secondary age children, I know that is just not right. You know, to expect children to be online 5 hours a day is, I don't think, is the answer. So right, coming back to the premise of there isn't a magic answer to remote learning. There's looking at a range of strategies. So yes, you might do some live lessons. You'll have some blended learning. You'll have some no screen time. I'm really interested in the idea of, you know, no screen Friday or wellbeing Wednesday that I'm seeing, you know, used across the sector. So there is that, first of all. If you're setting up your remote learning provision, you need a range of strategies. Don't just go down one route, because you run the risk of missing things. I think when you start delving down into that remote learning, and we talked about emotional intelligence earlier, I think as leaders, we have to be really humble in the field of remote learning. We however long it is ago, we can both remember teaching a full-time timetable. You know, I can remember, you know, my year 10, set 5 out of 6 on a Friday afternoon, last lesson after teaching the whole day, and how exhausting it was with that group of children. And they needed all of my energy, but I was, you know, exhausted by that point. So we understand that. Remote learning, I have not taught a full timetable of remote learning, as have hardly any leaders. We might have taught the odd lesson, but we don't know what it's like. We don't understand the pressure that our teachers are under trying to do blended learning of 10 children in their classroom and 20 at home. We don't understand that. So we have to be humble about that. So when, you know, in the book, there are elements of quality assurance. Again, I think it's being really careful about how you quality assure remote learning. And actually, we don't really know what a good one looks like. We've got an idea. We certainly haven't delivered a good one ourselves. So I think it's taking those things and being humble and trying to think of the pressure that's on your teachers. So if you're putting in a quality assurance system, and there are elements of that talked of in the book, think about what the purpose is. The purpose should be not to grade anything. The purpose should be, how do we improve practice? That is what it's about. How can we share? So there's a lot of ideas in the book about how we share information, how we take, you know, information on really quality creative teaching, and how we share that around our school. So one of the things that we've done at Infinity last week was we asked all our teachers to give us an idea, nothing complicated, just an idea that's helped them with their remote learning. And I brought them all together and put them in a booklet. I think I've sent you a copy of it, so you've seen that. And yeah, it's on the Infinity Academy's website. And it's, again, it's those little ideas that are shared across the staff. So whereas no silver bullets is the normal situation, the status quo, and you can apply it to remote learning, also think in your own setting, what are the great ideas? What are the little things that you can share across your school, your partnership of schools, your academy trust, or even wider?
It's a really sensible approach, you know, sharing things that are working in your context, things where you've experienced success, but being really careful to not make anything hierarchical and saying that this strategy is better than the other, because the truth is we just don't know. And I always worry when I've seen a few posts where people have written things like, the research tells us, and I'm thinking, what research? Is there a statistical correlation between student achievement and remote teaching? I don't know. I haven't seen any yet. So I think we just need to be really careful, because like you said, our teachers are under an incredible amount of pressure teaching in this way. But that feels like a really supportive way of doing it. So I'm going to talk to you about music in a moment, a random deviation from the conversation, but I'll explain why in a moment. Blame Phil Naylor. But where can people buy the book?
Okay, so the book's available on Amazon. You can buy it as the Kindle version and the paperback version. So that's the place to find it. If you just search No Silver Bullets or Day In, Day Out School Improvement or my name, Paul Ainsworth, it will come up. It's also on my, you know, you'll see it on my Twitter feed. So I'm at PK Ainsworth, and I'm sure that will be in the notes for this conversation. So that's the easiest place to get the book. And I'm more than happy to engage with people on social media. So if people find me and want to ask me things, that's great. I've had some really good direct message conversations over the last few days about some of the ideas in the book from people that I don't know and from colleagues that I've not seen for a while. So yeah, Amazon, that's the easiest place to find the book at the moment.
And is Twitter the best way for people to get in contact with you and engage with you?
Yes, that's the best place. I'm also on LinkedIn, but yeah, Twitter's the easiest place to engage with me. I'm not on Instagram yet. I maybe need to get you to teach me how to do that, Abby.
Does this need to be an outcome of this podcast? An Instagram tutorial? Okay, I think we need to make this happen. And do we have a No Silver Bullets hashtag?
I've started doing that. Again, you've been on social media for a while, but it was only yesterday I thought I've not done the No Silver Bullets hashtag, and there isn't one out there, so I am starting to use that as well.
Excellent. Yeah. So listeners, please use the No Silver Bullets hashtag as well. Great. Okay, so Phil Naylor has introduced a musical element to the podcast and has asked me to ask you about your favourite song. Now, this feels very convenient given the musical element to your book. So can you share with the listeners the Day In, Day Out reference?
Okay, so people who follow me on Twitter know that in between tweeting about school improvement, the other big thing that I tweet about is my love of the band Joy Division. So Joy Division were a post-punk band of the late 70s from Manchester. Tragically, the lead singer Ian Curtis died just when they were about to go on an American tour, and Joy Division then reinvented themselves as New Order, that I suspect more listeners will be aware of. I have a range of favourite songs, and this isn't necessarily my favourite Joy Division song, but the line in it is so interesting. So the song is Digital, which is on Unknown Pleasures, and the line is Day In, Day Out, Day In, Day Out. Day in, day out, day in, day out, day in, day out. When I hear Ian Curtis sing that, I just think that is the line. So that's where that comes from. Over recent years, what's really interesting, I've got a teenage son. And I gave him the bass guitarist from New Order and Joy Division is Peter Hook. So I gave him his autobiography to read. And my son read the autobiography and said, "Oh, Dad, I want to form a band." What instrument are you going to play? He said drums, and I said, "I don't want drums, please not drums. How about bass guitar, like hooky?" So he started playing bass guitar. And prior to lockdown, this is what I don't know about you, what you're missing most about lockdown. I'm missing live music. Mm. I'm missing going to gigs. And me and my son went to see Peter Hook play live a few times where he was playing Joy Division songs. It was great to hear him sing Day In, Day Out, and Love Will Tear Us Apart and Ceremony and things like that. My proudest moment of the last 18 months, so people say, what's your proudest moment? Is it having your book published? My proudest moment is 14 months ago, my son played his first professional gig, that people paid for and he got paid for doing. And during the gig, he started a song, and the song was Shadow Play by Joy Division. He said, "This one's for my dad." To the centre of the city where a road's been waiting for you.
That must have been such an emotional moment.
That was so cool. So yeah, the book comes from my love of Joy Division and that kind of well-being thing. Ian Curtis died of suicide. I think as teachers, we're really conscious of the pressure people are under, and trying to, you know, and support people. So I always wear my, if those people who know me know, I always wear my Joy Division pin on my jacket. And part of that's about that well-being as well. How do we look after people? How do we make sure, you know, everyone's okay in these difficult times? So yeah, day in, day out, digital, Joy Division, look them up. You might not have heard them before. It's not necessarily the happiest music, but they are probably one of the most influential bands of the late 70s, early 80s. And you'll hear bands like U2 or The Killers or Moby even, who are their great influences, and they'll say Joy Division.
I feel I've missed a trick and could have invited you and your son on to perform just to finish off the podcast.
You know, he's missing performing so much. You know, his band Current Climate, you know, they've got their stuff on Spotify and SoundCloud, and they're really missing performing, and I'm missing seeing them play as well.
Well, hopefully one day very soon you'll be able to see them perform live again. Paul, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you as always. Good luck with promoting the book. I can't wait to get mine. I can't believe I still haven't had my copy, despite you posting it to me. I think this is the consequence of living in the middle of nowhere, but hopefully it will arrive in the next few days and I can delve into it properly. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Abby.
Procession moves on, the shouting is over. Praise to the glory of loved ones now gone. Talking aloud as they sit round their tables, scattering flowers washed down by the rain. Stood by the gate at the foot of the garden, watching them pass like clouds in the sky. Try to cry out in the heat of the moment, possessed by a fury that burns from inside.